All right. Now, it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Robert Chen. Bob Chen is the director of CSIN, the Center for International Earth Science Information at Columbia University. As that title suggests, he's a great expert on information and data systems, and is also the Secretary General of CODATA, the Committee on Data for Science and Technology of ICSU, the International Council of Science. I'm particularly delighted to have Bob make this presentation this afternoon because he's going to tell us, I think, about the information commons, which reminds us that international spaces include not only the usual spaces that are, in some sense, easy to recognize in geographical terms, but as we move into today's age, there are other kinds of resources or systems which need to be thought of in the context of international spaces as well. So with that introduction, Bob, let me turn it over to you.
Great. Thanks, Oren, and I'm glad to be here and have a chance to talk to you about, I think, a very important related issue that is certainly part of the discussion about the Antarctic Treaty as well as other spaces, as has been mentioned. I've been told I have about 5 minutes less than I thought, so let me start going into this fairly quickly. Most of you, I'm sure, know this. The Antarctic Treaty has a provision about open access to data. Certainly, it's in a strict sense, it only applies to the member states, but my understanding is that it's been interpreted a little more broadly. I didn't put down that this was the first information commons established. I haven't researched that. There may be others. I'm pretty sure they didn't talk about free access to data in the Magna Carta, though. So this is certainly an early example. But to kind of give you a little perspective, of course, as we've heard, the Antarctic Treaty came from the same era as the IGY. And another one of the legacies of the IGY was the World Data Center System, which is a network that existed partly for, I think, science diplomacy reasons to enable scientific cooperation between East and West during the Cold War. And as some of you know, it was a way in which scientists were able to actually travel to other data centers and exchange data for international scientific efforts in meteorology, climatology, and other fields. And in fact, this network is in the process under ICSU's supervision of rethinking itself as a broader world data system covering a lot more topics and trying to focus, or at least beginning to focus, more on north-south issues, not just the traditional east-west ones. There are two new world data centers, for example, being established. The blue one is the one that I run at Columbia on human interactions in the environment. But the ICSU has been involved in a number of other activities. You are all, I'm sure, familiar with the International Polar Year. And one of the aspects of the Polar Year was this concept of free and open access to polar data. At least in some of the original documents, it was recognized that it's really the data that's one of the main legacies of the Polar Year. Actually, thinking back a couple centuries over the time period of exploration and research. And so the IPY data policy tried to clarify what that meant in terms of data sharing with all the IPY projects and but taking into account some appropriate restrictions. So, again, thinking about data as a shared resource in the science community, there's also, ICSU has taken a stand on this, and in fact, they're in the process of drafting a statement on universality of science in the polar regions. I don't think it's been released yet. This is just one of many examples, but if you read the current literature, for example, this just came out a couple months ago in Nature, there's much greater recognition in the scientific community and in a lot of different fields about the value of open access to data and data sharing. There are also many other frameworks to think about. One which actually has legal standing is the OECD principles for access to research data with public funding. And this is something that all the OECD countries and research agencies have actually agreed to and suggest this principle along with a number of others, saying that, you know, it's really important to have the data that governments fund to be made public for general benefit. And I don't have time to go into some of the other statements. There's certainly statements in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other international declarations associated with the World Summit on the Information Society and so forth that at least establish, if not a legal, a ethical basis for data sharing in science. Now, I always try to put in something about why open access is important. I think we've heard many examples already, certainly related to the Antarctic and the cryosphere in general, about why it's important. This is just a map from the IPCC Working Group 2 report that shows that really climate change is a ongoing issue, that there are detectable regional impacts of climate change in not just the cryosphere, but terrestrial and marine ecosystems around the world. So this is not a theoretical problem anymore. And, of course, even in the absence of climate change, there's lots of other reasons to share data for the common benefit. One of them is hazards and disaster mitigation. And just to put a personal note on this, this is a paper that the first paper I ever published, which was on sea level rise impacts, and it's kind of appropriate that we're sitting here in Washington around the mall where the sea level contours are evident. And, of course, this was done by hand before geographic information systems had been invented. But the basic idea is that, of course, the Antarctic has potentially important implications for the rest of the world. One has to think about the intersection between the physical changes in the climate and human occupants of the land and the surface, because these are affected not just by the direct sea level rise, but by the potential effects on storm surge, on saltwater intrusion, and so forth that affect the growing populations in the coasts. So getting to the international spaces part of this, there's, of course, one of the trends over the past, actually recent years, is a vast expansion of the use of outer space for Earth observation. And really moving from what you might call a relatively data-sparse arena to a much more data-rich future in which many satellites, many platforms, many countries will be collecting important Earth observation data. So there has been an international initiative started around 2003 but formalized in 2005 called the Group on Earth Observations. And it's an interesting... It's certainly different from the Antarctic Treaty because it's an entirely voluntary intergovernmental organization. And it has currently, actually just a couple weeks ago, reached 80 national members plus the European Commission and more than 50 participating organizations. But again, it's a voluntary regime, so it's been kind of an interesting group to work with. One of the things that was accepted in 2005 was a set of data sharing principles that are essentially accepted upon application for membership. And it calls for full and open exchange of data, metadata, and products shared within GIOS, recognizing relevant international instruments and national policies and legislation. So it's nice to have this principle, but one has to think about how does the principle relate to all the other applicable laws and treaties and policies that exist. And that actually was a task that fell actually to CoData to work on in developing what we call the implementation guidelines for these data sharing principles. This was a couple-year process of working with this voluntary group to define and clarify certain issues, like what is the definition for full and open access? Can people reuse and redisseminate data that they get from this system? What is a reasonable time delay, and what is pricing? What's a reasonable pricing policy? And so part of our activity, actually the first time I worked with, wrote a paper with three other lawyers, since I'm not, was to review the experience in and the practice of the last few decades in thinking about Earth observation data, and using that as kind of the basis for trying to make GEO make progress on data sharing. So that those guidelines were actually accepted with the modifications in plenary about 2 weeks ago here in Washington, and we're in the process of developing some more concrete actions and policies to, or actually procedures to implement these guidelines by the next plenary and ministerial in fall 2010. But there's a, you know, it's still an open question as to whether a voluntary regime can really make progress. So there has been countries like Brazil and China that have made commitments to open up the data that they're collecting from a new set of satellites. But there are other countries, the U.S. in particular, who have used the potentially broad label of national security to not release important data. In this case, an example is the shuttle radar topographic mission data set from that was done almost 10 years ago, which the U.S. won't distribute openly at a high resolution for countries other than the U.S. So that has led CoData and other groups to think about other approaches to opening up access to data. And the one that I think is the most relevant to this group, of course, is this thing we're calling the Polar Information Commons. And it's an idea that comes out of direct work with the IPY Data Committee and other groups. We were working with the Scientific Committee on Antarctic Data Management and a number of other groups. I'll show the list later. But to really build on the Antarctic Treaty legal commons, the information commons embedded in the Antarctic Treaty, and try to generalize it a bit to cover, A, both poles, but also a broader range of stakeholders, so non-treaty members, non-scientists, and others. And it's trying to build on the internet experience in looking at new ways of developing open access data sharing regimes within the internet community. Obviously, extending this to the Arctic is not easy, and that I probably don't have time to go into it, but there are other people here who are more expert on this issue. But the idea is to build on something you may have heard about, the Creative Commons, which is an organization that has very successfully opened up copyrightable material to the public. And if you look online, you can use Google and other tools to actually search for intellectual property that's licensed under the Creative Commons, because they used a digital license that has actually been harmonized across almost all legal jurisdictions on copyright. And then if you own copyright, you can then give away rights to other people to use it with a few restrictions if you want them. So that's the approach. But in data, it's much more complicated because, at least in some jurisdictions, data is not copyrightable. The U.S. government puts its data in the public domain, but other jurisdictions don't. So Creative Commons developed what they call the Science Commons Protocol for implementing open data access. and they propose or they recommend using a open access waiver called CC0 to basically put everything in the public domain if it's not there already. Of course, scientists and others may not want to do that if they don't have some sense that their not ownership, but their stake in having generated that data and so forth isn't respected. And so Science Commons says, well, you solve that problem by having community norms, by having clear digital tools to label it, to search for it, to allow peer pressure and other types of incentives to work. So without getting into great detail, what we envision is a kind of a virtual information commons where anybody, I mean, even people with pictures of penguins and seals, can donate their data or their copyrighted information or their software to this Polar Information Commons. But because they're digitally labeled, actually the scientific data management infrastructure is actually much freer to mine that data, collect it, improve the documentation, integrate it, and do the kind of cross-disciplinary integration that you saw in previous talks is very important for the polls and other areas. So let me try to wrap up. Two sides. I think it's a two-way issue. Why is the Antarctic Treaty important to the PIC? Well, obviously it has that legal embedding of data sharing as part of the structure. And again, only for those treaty signatories, but certainly easily extensible to the rest of the world. And it also gives this example where you can see the value of cross-disciplinary data sharing, international data sharing, longevity. I think we heard some good examples in the last 2 days of this, of sharing between government and non-governmental entities, and not just for science, but for very practical purposes. But the flip side is, why is the PIC potentially important to the Antarctic Treaty? And, you know, again, just thinking about what I learned about last 2 days, you know, when it turns out that the ozone hole is changing the wind structure, which is changing the ocean circulation, which might change the ice shelf dynamics and the biological productivity and other aspects of the Antarctic, you understand how difficult it is if every discipline's working separately with separate pots of data, how difficult it is to understand those connections. And only by putting the data together very openly and freely do you have the opportunity to discover that these connections may really exist and may really be important for sustainable management, not just of the Antarctic, but the globe as a whole. And I think also just having this as an open resource will be a valuable outreach tool that anyone can mine for both education, research, and practical benefit, whether it's commercial or non-commercial. So let me just sum up. I'm ahead of time. You know, we are clearly in an information society. I think the discussion earlier about people faxing and typing things is interesting because, you know, certainly in the last decade we've moved to, and we're looking ahead to a very digital future and with a new generation that's thinking about things digitally. And not really, we don't really have the tools yet to know how well we can preserve digital information into the future and how well... how quickly that will evolve, whether the software will keep up and so forth. So there's lots of opportunities for the Antarctic Treaty system, I think, to take advantage of these new technologies, you know, GPS, cameras on seals, all that stuff. And taking an open access approach rather than a proprietary approach has a lot of potential benefits for thinking about this future. Because it facilitates the interdisciplinary research and data integration and so forth, as I've said. And certainly, I know some of the funders are looking at this purely from an efficiency viewpoint because there's a lot of duplication of effort, you know, multiple satellites going up that are doing the same thing. There's really a big efficiency argument as well for thinking about open access. That's certainly true for NIH and other groups that have enforced open access mechanisms in their fields. So let me just conclude. There's a flyer and there's a website for the Polar Information Commons. We are still in the development stage. It's not a production system yet. We hope to have a formal launch by the June meeting in Oslo. And we certainly welcome people to participate and contribute in this activity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bob, and it gives me great pleasure to give you a medal on behalf of the board of the Antarctic Treaty Summit.
Thank you, Rory.